Does the university and community organizations come together to fund the Professor Churchill's visit?
Our university president, David McLean, has defended this invitation despite disagreement with Churchill's now famous statements, or infamous statements, regarding the 9/11 bombings. Churchill's presence here in Hawaii was occasioned by the ongoing firestorm of protests against him because of a speech in which he indicted American foreign policy and its, quote, technocrats of empire, end quote, now engaged in a global war for resources. A witch-hunting investigation conducted by the University of Colorado was announced on February 4th. The purpose of this review, according to the Colorado Chancellor, is, quote, to determine whether Professor Churchill may have overstepped his bounds as a faculty member, end quote. The Chancellor goes on to say, in direct violation of academic freedom, that Churchill's conduct, including his speech, will be examined, quote, for grounds for dismissal for cause, end quote. We oppose that. Like the House Un-American Activities Committee hearings in the 1950s, the Colorado investigation of Ford Churchill is nothing less than McCarthyism. That's what it is, McCarthyism. For this reason alone, if for no other, we at the University of Hawaii and all others concerned for civil liberties must, absolutely must, and categorically must, defend Ward Churchill's constitutional right to speak his mind as a public intellectual. In this spirit, we welcome Professor Churchill to this campus. As the author of over 12 books and dozens of articles, Professor Churchill is uniquely qualified to speak on the conditions and the subjugations of those of us in the third and the fourth world. His scholarly publications include books on the FBI's war against the Black Panther Party, the genocidal impact of American Indian residential schools, Holocaust and denial in the Americas, indigenous peoples and Anglo-American law, and, most importantly, the struggle for American Indian liberation. I have known Professor Churchill for 15 years. I applaud his tireless contributions, including to our own Hawaiian Sovereignty Tribunal, when he came as a comrade for us to testify on behalf of Native peoples the world over. I am urging public support of Professor Churchill's struggle as if it were our own, that is to say, the Native people of Hawaii. To paraphrase the incomparable African-American writer James Baldwin, in his support of the vindicated Angela Davis, during her long, harrowing, and trumped-up trial for murder, quote, if they take Ward in the morning, they will be coming for all of us this night. Thank you.
Do we have anybody else who would be prepared to make a statement, or brief statement at this point?
Okay. So we're going to go to a question and answer period with Professor Churchill.
How surprised were you by the reaction and your comments about 9/11?
We need to clip them first, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Sorry, wait.
Professor Churchill, is it possible for you to take off your mask?
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much.
Any other aesthetic details need?
Okay, I'd ask you again, how surprised were you by the fury, your comments, and gender?
Well, the mostly surprising part of it is it's round two. This was not a secret. The piece was originally written on 9/11 itself in response to the questions being posed on the media and my own need to come to grips with what it was that had happened in my own mind. And that instigated a mini firestorm at the time. And for 3.5 years later, after the piece had been refined and developed and fully annotated, published in a book and won a human rights award for writing, for it suddenly to be discovered, quote, end quote, and turned into a stalking horse for a broader agenda on repression of academic freedom was a little surprising, but in a way predictable as well.
Is that from the O'Reilly faction? Is that who brought it to?
The source of this is a little bit mysterious. There was an organized right-wing organizational effort to basically repeal a liberal program at Hamilton College. The program had been targeted for the last year to 18 months. I would assume that the source comes from upstate New York originally, and that O'Reilly picked up on it, but I do not know that for a fact. So I know that O'Reilly was able to propel it to national attention in combination with Joe Scarborough and others. It's been a sort of a feeding frenzy around rather staid interpretation of U.S. policy. If you want to frame it in context, the same argument has been made by Chalmers Johnson in Blowback by individual CIA agent who attempted to remain anonymous in a book called Imperial Hubris. Approximately similar arguments made by any number of other people in the literature that's emerged since 2001. Noam Chomsky comes to mind, but there are many others. So the reason for singling this particular essay out in an aversion that was essentially a visceral response from the gut, published within 24 hours of the event, hanging on an obscure website where, incidentally, I can't even find it, sort of speaks for itself in a way. But the important thing to bear in mind here is that the piece itself is no longer issued. It's not what I said that's become the issue, but the right to say it. Not the content of the article that's now at issue, but me myself. We're continuously critiqued by the likes of David Horowitz, Newt Gingrich for pursuing what they call identity politics, but you look at the nature of the response now, it's nothing but identity politics being pursued by the right in an effort to discredit me. And in discrediting me, as Newt Gingrich has framed it, I don't know how exactly I earned this lustrous status, but in discrediting me, they tend to discredit ethnic studies programs and dissident opinion throughout the academy, and he's openly announced on Fox News and MSNBC both that this is the kickoff and an agenda to roll back divergent opinion throughout the academy, that there will be essentially organizations established on the basis of ideological perspective similar to his own, and that they will vet the credentials and qualifications of all members of the faculty on a national basis. And in my own state and a board of regents, there have been statements that individual regents who share that particular ideological perspective articulated by Gingrich and others, it's going to be self-empowering to vet entire departments, individual faculty members, and every single course in the core curriculum. Now that's imposition of a political lie in the name of academic integrity. And ultimately, if you examine it for 10 seconds, it's a reverse of academic integrity. It's conversion of the academy in the United States, and this is the announced intent, to convert the academy in the United States to a cheering section for red, white, and blue as they define it. And that's the opposite function of academic enterprise in a free society. So the stakes are very high. They're much higher than me. I've got my own vested interest in the outcome, obviously. But I've got a vested interest in the outcome in the broader sense as well. That's the reason in my talk in the University of Colorado that they attempted to prevent. I announced myself basically in the tradition of the Cheyenne, on whose land I'm teaching in Colorado, to have staked myself out. In other words, taken a picket pin and driven it in the ground as a part of my defense. I can retreat no further than the rope attached to the pin. And that's no distance at all. There is no retreat. There is no backing up. There is no give here. The stakes are very, very real. The stakes are very real, not simply in the state of Colorado or at the University of Colorado, but throughout the nation. The whole edifice of academic freedom and critical engagement and stimulating public debate is at issue. They want none and have said so.
Professor Churchill, you
are a poster boy at this point for freedom of speech.
Poster boy for academic freedom, perhaps. but it's not a position that I selected. It's one that's been imposed. I want to talk about what I talk about, not whether I have a particular right to talk about it. But I need to make one thing clear here. The right to speak is unconstrained. That's a right vested in every citizen in the United States. But those whose vocation is academia and here beyond the right, the obligation. It is our job to confront orthodoxy in a critical fashion, to raise uncomfortable questions, to insult people, if you will, in order to force response and in the response form a dialogue that furthers public understanding of issues. In effect, I've been targeted for elimination, and beyond that, subject areas of critical inquiry such as ethnic studies, such as Hawaiian studies would be here, American Indian studies, Afro-American studies, women's studies, and so on, targeted for elimination. We're not to be a part of the discourse. You're not to have dissonance in the conversation. It's all to be affirmation of the status quo. And that is an extraordinarily dangerous agenda.
President Churchill, you
said, when you talk, the misunderstanding seems to be technocrats and inquire how that is.
Frame your question again, please, and then I think you've got one.
Well, I've basically the same question. I was wondering if you could kind of use, you called your essay a gut visceral response. Could you tell us what were the points that you were trying to make in that essay?
Well, the points I was working off of was before the first of the buildings even came down, after the second plane had come in and hit, but before either of the towers had come down, they were already describing what it was that had happened as being senseless. And I'm asking myself at that point, would anyone do this in coordinated fashion for no reason at all? And if they had a reason, it's obviously not senseless. And how did the people framing it this way for public consumption on CNN and Fox News and the other networks, how would they know it's senseless? So what might the sense be? What might the motive have been? And worked it out from there. And ultimately it comes down to, if you entitle yourself for profit to kill other people's babies and imagine that to be with impunity, you're in for a rude awakening. Here's the rude awakening. There will be consequences.
I was just wondering if there's anything you've said that you've regretted publicly, that you've publicly said.
No, I don't. I don't regret anything at all other than I did not have opportunity within the framework of what I was assigned to do, which is provide this visceral response within 12 hours to fully develop the thesis. But I've since done so, so on that basis alone, I have no regrets. I could have refined, I could have explained further, not in the time available to me at that time, which is one conspicuous reason why the discourse has been framed only in terms of the original email or website or whatever you call it, posting, rather than the fully developed version of the essay attended by 178 footnotes that appears in a book called On the Justice of Roosting Chickens. Readily available, and as I say, it's been awarded runner-up status for the Gustavus Myers Award for Best Writing in Human Rights for 2004. But you see very little mention of that in the media. It's like, I wrote this thing and that was the last thing that ever happened. It's not.
Could you explain the comment about the little icon? That seems to have triggered much of the controversy. Could you explain to layman's terms, to those who have not read your essay, what you were trying to say there?
Eichmann, the big Eichmann, the real Eichmann, who was symbolic even in his own context, was not a mass murderer. He was not a killer. He was not the entity you see in the Hollywood portrayals of the Holocaust. He was a bureaucrat who didn't necessarily even agree with the policy that he was implementing, but used his technical proficiency to make the train schedules function properly, to make the transfers of gold teeth to the Reichsbank function properly, who did all these sorts of logistical things as a bureaucrat, as a technocrat, and was ultimately held accountable on the basis of his amoral pursuit of personal prestige by making a system function that resulted, to his knowledge, in the deaths of millions. Now, when you do that, irrespective of your particular station, when you're an investment banker who avails himself of what the World Bank and the IMF announce as being the imposition of stability in third world context so you can have profit maximization, and you trade on that and you enrich yourself and you advance yourself on that basis in knowledge that the imposition of those conditions of stability upon which you're trading result in the massive miseration and death of the populations whose resources you're exploiting, you're functioning in the capacity of an Eichmann. Now, I made reference to little Eichmanns. Eichmann himself symbolized those who worked under him. He symbolized the technicians at A.G. Farben who manufactured the gas. He symbolized the people whose job it was to operate the trains that transported the victims to the Holocaust sites. They, too, never killed anyone. They, too, were bureaucrats. They were lesser. They are not known as well. But as he symbolized those under him and working in corollary capacities to him in the functioning of the Holocaust in the Third Reich, so too does he symbolize those who perform similar functions of similar immorality in other societies. And that's a lesson that was drawn from the Eichmann trial by Hannah Arendt. That's who I had in mind when I used the Eichmann phrase. I would advise everyone to revisit that book. It's a short book that she wrote as a result of having attended the trial in Israel after Eichmann was taken from Argentina by Mossad. And basically what she said in this book, which title of which is Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, is that she had gone to confront the epitome of evil. That's what Eichmann symbolized to her. She expected something monstrous. What she encountered instead was an absolutely nondescript, mousy little man who had performed the functions I've already described. And the conclusion she drew was that the evil of Eichmann was not that he was a Nazi, although he was, but that Eichmann represented the fact that anyone could be a Nazi, that he was every man, and that which made Nazism especially malignant was its commonality with all of its purported opponents. That Eichmann lived as readily in New York as he had in Berlin, and that Eichmann could live in any other advanced and advancing society which was trading in the rotting flesh of children for development of economic gain.
Do you understand at all how some of the 9/11 victims could have been offended by that, or maybe misinterpreted what you said?
Can you understand how some Germans were mightily offended by the portrayal of them in the aftermath of what it was they did? Yes, that's to be expected. That was the point. See how it feels to be called by your right name, and if you don't like it, maybe instead of rejecting and vilifying the messenger, you might want to change your comportment and your outlook. And if you change your comportment and your outlook, the nature of what you do in the rest of the world will be substantively changed as well, and maybe people will not have a burning desire, a motive, if you will, to fly planes into your buildings and set you on fire like you set them on fire, too.
You're talking about Eichmann, though, who was a member of the Nazi Party, and, you know, you say a bureaucrat and functioning to smooth things over and make them work better. Going over to 9/11, you're talking about people that are not quite on that direct path. And you're talking, I assume that your technic class of empire, you just mean the investment bankers, is that right? Who do you include in that phrase? I mean, there are 3,000 people that died.
Well, I think for starters, you could take the language that I used and parse out janitors, for example, food service workers, children, random passers-by. All focus was on my supposed characterization of such people as being little Eichmanns, okay? Which was a diversion. Self-evidently, when I used the framing, the verbiage having to do with technicians and technical corps, I was not including those people in that characterization, but there was this false effort which was concerted to defend their memory from what I never called them in the first place. So, yes, we have narrowed it down to people who function in investment and brokerage and trading capacities, those who make the system hum. If you can come up with a definition by which somebody who pushes a broom for a living becomes a technician, I'd like to hear it, but I'm unaware of it. So that was a red herring from the get-go. However, those people, those janitors, those children even, would in U.S. Pentagonese, the parlance of the Defense Department, be consigned to a status known as collateral damage, which is not too comforting here either. But the point, again, is this. I didn't expect it would be comfortable to describe the victims in those terms. And in that, illustrate the fact it's not exactly comfortable to those who are losing their loved ones and hundreds of thousands and millions out there somewhere, where human life really doesn't count to the policymakers of the United States and the broad swath of the public that supports them. And if it's uncomfortable to you, maybe in that cognition, you can understand how discomforting it is to them and why they would respond as they did. My point was that anyone placed in that position, doesn't matter whether you're American, you're Arab, or you're something else, if you're placed in that position, you will respond this way. And they have responded to me that way, through terrorism.
What did you want to accomplish? Some change in government policy? Did you want the American people to think in a different way?
I want American people to think in a different way. American policy does not function as American policy does without a mass cheering section of at least acquiescing people. Stop acquiescing. Value a life in Iraq the same as you value those 3,000 in the United States, and maybe we will be coming up not only with an alteration of consciousness that will allow for a little basic humanity to emerge in the equation, but ultimately you will have begun to develop what you could call a security system, eliminating the motives.
Looking at this is looking at it broadly, and your goal is to inspire and to awaken people.
It's to stimulate critical engagement. Think about it. Think about it. And the whole discourse of response, I finally, just before I left, came here, and this was from a mother of a man who was a fireman and killed on 911. I finally had somebody, I guess you could consign to the critical side of the chorus of complaint here, who actually mentioned the Iraqi mothers and how they must feel too, and the Palestinian mothers whose children are killed in the Intifada, throwing rocks and getting shot in the head. That kind of a symmetry. The first mention, there has not been a mention of one brown-skinned body from all of those whose absolute absorption, self-absorption, if you will, has been with 3,000 Americans. And so long as that's the case, the problem that generated 911 is clear and apparent.
Do you feel you owe any apology to these, you know, the families of the cooks and the collateral damage, as you call them?
Absolutely not. That might be a little situational. The moment I start hearing apologies to the Iraqis and the Palestinians, maybe I'll reconsider my position. But as things stand now, I'm reinforced in the idea that no apology is due, given their own behavior in the aftermath of being treated in something similar to the same fashion. But when I say that, bear in mind, I didn't do it, unlike those who stand at the podium in the Pentagon. And I am not supporting those who did it in that sense. So even on the basis of what was said and the way the victims were categorized, we're comparing apples and oranges. Those out there have far more reason to be bitterly resentful and to respond in kind than does anyone in the United States based upon anything I've said.
Professor Churchill, before this issue, you were involved in a lot of other things, Native American issues and such. Has this controversy affected your opportunities to do work in those other areas?
Well, this is rather recent, so it remains to be seen. I'm, at the present time, utterly preempted from doing what it is that I do and what I value, the kind of analysis that I do, into dealing with this particular issue. These are the terms that were imposed. I have no particular alternative but to accept them, either by acquiescence or capitulation, or by simply standing my ground and saying, take your best shot.
My position is,
take your best shot.
I have a question. You said that the towers could have been considered a military target
That's correct.
Of what was in there. There's a situation right now here in Hawaii on this campus to try to turn this university into a UARC, which is a, would allow them to do classified research that the DOD would then be able to keep from the public. Do you think that turns this institution into a military target if they're developing things that could become weapons of mass destruction?
According to the rules of engagement applied by Donald Rumsfeld and his cohorts in the Department of Defense in justifying target selection in Baghdad and other places, this very much does. They hit civilian targets in Baghdad, and the justification that was officially pronounced is that evil Saddam Hussein had placed elements of command and control infrastructure in otherwise civilian-occupied buildings and facilities, and therefore it was legitimate to bomb them. And if that rule is imposed there and accepted by the public here has no complaint if the same rule is brought back to them. If you merge command and control, military and intelligence infrastructural components within civilian facilities, those facilities become legitimate targets according to the articulations of the United States itself. And if you accept that elsewhere, you have no complaint when it occurs here. That's the point. So if you don't want to be considered a legitimate military target by somebody else who's operating under U.S. enunciated rules, and you need to keep these things out of civilian facilities.
With that in mind, there are a lot of people have drawn parallel between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. Was the Japanese Empire justified in attacking Pearl Harbor?
Was the Japanese Empire justified in attacking Pearl Harbor? Well, there are a number of lines of analysis you can take on that. I don't go so far as to say justification in any of these contexts, but I think the best place to look is in the rubric of international law. And in the rubric of international law, colonialism, and that's what was happening here, U.S. occupation of somebody else's country for its own purposes, both economic and military, okay, that is a crime in law and to be repealed by such action as is necessary. Now, you've got two empires clashing there, but there is absolutely no basis for arguing that the Japanese attacked the United States on its home turf. This is Polynesia, not America.
Also, all right. Follow-up question. So, overall, would you consider the United States a force of evil or a force of good?
Rhetorically or in real politics? Rhetorically.
Overall, you take the American government, the American people, overall. Right?
Well, what I do by seizing on two things. One is what my elders have taught me, and the other is what I was taught in civics class in the 8th grade, okay? The stuff that I was taught in the 8th grade I believe to be of value. Of course, it was rhetoric, it was principle, it was ideal, but I've internalized those, and I choose to act on them, unlike, in my experience, most Americans.
There's been a bit of time. We've got time for one or two other questions, and then I do know that we have people here representing their groups who want to make a statement. So we ask you to stay for that. We have time for one or two other questions.
There's a big controversy.
Let me finish the last one. Okay, in terms of what it actually does in the world, the United States has turned itself into the opposite of the ideals it espouses. In that sense, it's overwhelmingly a force for evil.
There's been a big controversy about whether you're an American Indian or not, and if you got your special treatment in getting your job. Can you comment on that?
One, I didn't get any special treatment in getting my job on that basis or any other. I got my job the old-fashioned way. I worked for it.
And are you American Indian?
What's that have to do with anything? Are you a practitioner of identity politics?
Actually, there's a big controversy in the mainland about that, so that's why I'm asking.
There is no controversy among Indians on that score.
There actually is not. Okay, well, there's a lot of... Google you, and there's a lot of controversy
Google
on
you.
American Indians.
It's irrelevant, and I get 65 emails from the same guy every hour in the United States.
Actually, there's women and men.
Is that a no, sir?
What is it? I just said that it's a relevant question. What's the problem in understanding that? What is the problem with understanding it's an irrelevant question? That's what I said. That's what I meant.
But are you or aren't you?
It's an irrelevant question. Can you spell irrelevant? Thank you. Excuse me? No, I'm not.
Yeah,
you take it's an irrelevant question to no, I'm not?
I did, I guess, and you'd say yes if that word.
Self-evidently, I am. Now it's an irrelevant question.
Self-evidently, what does that mean?
Wait a second. Yeah. I'd like to know how you feel when the press does what they're doing to you right now on this issue. Because I personally have a problem with it, but I want to know how it is for you. Because this is a question people like to get hung up on, and I'm sure it's what's going to be on the news tonight.
This is flatly racist diversion from the nature of the issue.
Yeah. How is it racist if we're asking you if you're American Indian or not?
Would you ask George Bush to prove he's white?
I think he's sure. answering.
Who would you ask aside from an American Indian? Would you ask a black faculty member for proof of African
ancestry?
The
American Indians have denounced you, so that's in some places, so that's why we're asking.
I can find white people who have announced George as being something of a mixed nature, too. Does that make it something you're going to frame as a question to the President of the United States? And if not, why are you framing it to
that
me?
That is, you know, Professor Churchill has answered that question multiple times. And as you can hear from the crowd reaction to the back of me, I think that is an example.
Actually, let me come back for a second. Sometimes when I go to these things, I expect to encounter professional journalists.
Yeah.
All right? If you want to know about some federal pedigree slip, you call the band office in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, like you're doing your job. Okay? Read the federal law, what the criteria of identification are. Okay? And see if you read your cohort in the Rocky Mountain News, if they haven't established that I've been identifying the same way since I was a 10-year-old little boy. Self-identification is the first criteria. Community recognition is the second criteria. Grab something as obscure as C-SPAN and look at the community recognition when I spoke at the University of Colorado. And yes, I am an associate enrolled member of the Ketua Band of Cherokees. If you got questions about that, don't quote another journalist. Call the office. Act like you got some integrity of your own and your professional standard.
I have another question for the professor. Professor, there apparently you were quoted as suggesting that
we will be having a talk tomorrow at the Art Auditorium, in which Professor Churchill will be giving a talk, and he will have a question and answer period afterwards with the audience, and you are of course invited to that. Let me just remind you that the reason why we're holding this press conference is to call the academic community to its best behavior and to also call you to your best behavior. Certain questions are red herrings that detract from the main issues that Professor Churchill is bringing to the table. You do not have to behave in the way that Bill O'Reilly behaves.
We have
given you plenty of time to ask your questions. You will be speaking again tomorrow, where I'm sure the same questions will come up, and you will have an opportunity to put down those answers and to listen to what the crowd
says.
What we will do now is take in the statements from other people here who are in support of Professor Churchill and who are ready to give their statements.